Thank you very much. It is my pleasure to be here with you. And I've got to start by saying I'm a Yankee fan, not from the Civil War, but that other war. And the historian of the Confederacy is a hopeless Red Sox fan. The title of this speech includes some very powerful and potentially controversial words. The Confederacy. What was it? Who was it? That's clearly what we'll discuss tonight. History. Isn't this all about facts which happened and can't be changed? No, history is about our interpretation of those facts. And those interpretations can and should change. All history is indeed revisionist history. Otherwise, we wouldn't need new historians to do research and write new books. We can argue about history. My personal favorite was after the war in Virginia. The war is, it's clear which one we're talking about. It's not World War I or II. After the war, a group of Confederate generals were arguing about how could it have been that Robert E. Lee's invincible army of Northern Virginia lost the Battle of Gettysburg. And one of them said, you know, it was clearly Jeb Stuart's fault. He did not show up in time. He was not the eyes and ears he should have been. Another blamed Dick Ewell. He should have taken Culp's Hill on the first day, and if he had taken Culp's Hill, the battle wouldn't have been fought at Gettysburg. Another blamed old Pete Longstreet for his tardy attack on the second day on Little Round Top. And another old geezer actually blamed Robert E. Lee for ordering Pickett's charge. And it finally came around to George Pickett. And they said, well, General Pickett, what do you think? And he said, I always thought the Yankees had something to do with it. So that's history. Myths and memories. I got to admit, as a history buff before I joined the museum, I didn't appreciate how important those two words are to historians today. They are great words. Myths and memories are not lies or intentional falsehoods because they must rely on some grain of truth or at least on some perception of the truth, whatever the heck the truth is. If history is the interpretation of facts, then memory is the perception of the interpretation of those facts, and myths are those truisms which build up to support those perceptions. And I'm going to play with that a little bit as we go along. So let's examine a little history, memory, and mythology. But let's do it by pointing out a few of the wonderful inconsistencies between the warring sections and reflecting on how those myths have changed over time. So historical question number one, and at the you'll pardon me, I want to go right to the crux of the matter. What caused the Civil War, slavery or states' rights? In the mind of the Deep South, in the spring of 1861, it was clearly slavery that caused the original secession. You can read it in all the speeches and all the secession documents. But that was not the case of the Upper South. And when I say the Upper South, that's Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri. That was not the case in the Upper South. The ones that did secede, seceded because of Lincoln's coercion, and coercion was the magic strong word to him at the time. Lincoln was trying to enforce a union at the point of a bayonet by forcing the actions of Fort Sumter. He had been warned against these actions, but he simply misread the mind of over half of what we now call the South. And his call for troops doubled the size of the seceding states. And don't forget that the Upper South sided with the Lower South for a lot of reasons. And the protection of their property and slaves was high on the list, but it wasn't high enough to get them to secede in that first initial wave. Northern mythology is clear. The South, the whole South, not part of it, seceded because of slavery and started the war over it. That memory hasn't changed much in 150 years. The South, soon after the war, realizing that slavery wasn't a great idea and would not hold up in the court of public opinion, the South changed its memory. They no longer separated their sections into lower and upper. They were united in the opinion that it was states' rights. That opinion is still dominant in the public mind in the South today. But ask someone of that opinion exactly which rights were being defended other than slavery, or perhaps the right to secede, and you draw a blank stare. Clearly, it was not a state's right to decide not to obey the fugitive slave law up north, which was clearly a state's right, but that was not what the South was talking about. But we still haven't addressed in history what caused the war. Northern memory is clear. The South started it by firing on Fort Sumter. That was the cause. But the South would say, and most historians are coming around to the opinion, that Lincoln brought on the war by insisting on the preservation of the Union at the point of conflict. The Upper South in 1861 lost its faith in that Union. And as a Virginian, I could say that that Union which we Virginians were instrumental in creating. But the Upper South lost its faith in that Union when it was apparent that force was the only way to preserve it. But they did not invoke the Declaration's right to rebel. They invoked instead their interpretation of the Constitution's right to secede. But the state's right rationalization is as strong today in the Upper South as it is in the Lower South. Yes, the Civil War united two very different sections of the South, and that union persists politically to this day. You saw it in the election just a couple of weeks ago. Virginia was the only one of the former Confederate states to vote for Obama. The Northern myth of the cause of the war will be a long time in changing because it holds first and foremost that Lincoln was infallible. If you want to see a great example of this, go see the movie. But that's a little like the South's myth of an infallible Robert E. Lee. So historical question number two. Slavery was a Southern thing, wasn't it? In the 250 years of American history before the war, slavery was anything but a Southern thing. Old City on the Hill man John Winthrop owned slaves. In governing the first colony to officially make permanent chattel slavery legal, right here in Massachusetts in 1641. The royal family, whose family crest is still on the seal of the Harvard Law School, made their fortune from slaves. When Thomas Jefferson wrote, "All men are created equal," 13 slaveholding colonies signed that document. To them, all men certainly did not include African slaves. At that time, a greater proportion of households in Massachusetts owned slaves than in Virginia or South Carolina. And as an example of the occasional brutality north and south to those slaves, Paul Revere noted in his account of his ride that he had passed Mark's body. The body of a slave that had been tarred and left hanging by chains since 1755, right here in Somerville. Connecticut, where I still have a farm, didn't abolish slavery until 1848, and there were still slaves in New Jersey until the 13th Amendment was passed, month after the Civil War. The last slave sale was held in Wilmington, Delaware, 4 months after Appomattox. Most folks have no memory of slaves in the North. Some Southerners know about Northern slave traders, and they call it Northern complicity. Some go so far as to blame the North for making them buy the slaves. You know, the Yankees made us do it. It's kind of like the devil made me do it. But while the New York Historical Society's great exhibit a couple of years ago and Brown University's recent admission that it was built from slave money and recent research into the DeWolf family of Rhode Island has awakened the North to its slave past. Don't let the rednecks from Dixie blame it on you. They wanted the slaves. They needed it for cotton, which leads us to historical question number 3. What's up with that cotton thing? Despite the fact that we all study in school about King Cotton, nobody has a memory of how big a deal it actually was. Before the war, 70% of all U.S. exports were cotton, more than the Fortune 10,000 combined today. And over half of all U.S. tax revenues came from the tariffs on the export of cotton. Cotton's value shot through the roof, increasing the value of slaves, which almost tripled between 1840 and 1860. It was a Deep South phenomenon, which explains their sensitivity to the whole issue. The Upper South was actually making its money by selling their slaves to the Deep South. More capital was invested in slaves by 1860 than in all Northern industry combined. But Southerners have no memory of that, because they would then have to face up to a memory of slavery as a booming business, not as a dying one. Let's stay with slavery for the next big history question. Laurie Latour wrote in the Boston Globe 2 years ago, quote, "When it comes to slavery, the story that New England has long told itself goes like this. Slavery happened in the South, and it ends thanks to the North. New England is the home of abolitionists and underground railroads. In the story of slavery, and by extension, the story of race and racism in modern-day America, we're the heroes, aren't we?" End of quote. And I would add by further extension, the South of the bad guys. Northern mythology would say that's correct. It's what Robert Penn Warren called the North's, quote, "treasury of virtue," allowing them to draw on it anytime they wanted to claim that they were better than Southerners, right up to modern times. Warren did add that, quote, "moral narcissism is peculiarly unlovely and unlovable trait, and the North was and still is guilty of it." Even as late as 1860, true abolitionists were still a very small minority, even here in Massachusetts. And the Republican Party was about as old as our current Tea Party. We were almost all racist. We white people were almost all racist, even by 20th century definition of it, much less our current common understanding. It was well known to almost all white people that Africans were inferior human beings. So the common understanding, North and South, was that if freed, they must be sent back to Africa. Frederick Douglass's heated debate with Abraham Lincoln, which lasted until Lincoln drafted the Emancipation Proclamation more than a year after the war's start, was over just this issue, as Lincoln also believed they should be sent back to Africa. Talk about something that's not in the Lincoln movie. There were only two problems with this solution. Nobody could come up with the money to do it, and they didn't want to go. Before the war, Southern emancipationists had an even more difficult problem. Not only could they not send their slaves back to Africa, they couldn't send them up north either, as most northern states would not allow it. Southern emancipationists had a real problem, best illustrated by the fact that Virginia's General Assembly voted in 1832, 1 year after Nat Turner's insurrection, by a margin of one vote, not to abolish slavery. The abolition of slavery in Virginia in 1832 lost by one vote. The reason? We can't send them back to Africa. We can't send them up north. We simply can't assimilate them into our society, so the only way to control them is to continue with slavery. More importantly, in 1861, Northern men did not sign on to fight a war to free the slaves. They wanted to save the Union, the still new American experiment with a constitutional democratic republic. As a result, Lincoln walked a tightrope when he issued his proclamation. He wanted to keep England out of the war, and he wanted to incite slave results. But he wanted to keep Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware in the Union. And he didn't want his army to walk out on him. He succeeded in all but one of his missions. There was no slave revolt. But his actions did lead hundreds of thousands of slaves to flee at the first opportunity. Self-emancipation is what we call it. Depriving the South of its economic ability to wage war and refilling the ranks of a depleting Union army with new American troops. By the end of the war, there were more black men in blue uniforms than there were white men in gray uniforms. They were the true freedom fighters. But the memory persists in the North of its virtue, and the South persists in its resentment of that memory. And nothing, and I mean nothing, irritates a Southerner more than when some arrogant damn Yankee compares the Confederates to Nazis. And it happens more often than you would believe. Now for a big memory question. What's the deal with the lost cause? The era of Reconstruction was truly awful for white Southerners. Wanting badly to substitute states' rights for slavery as the cause of the war, and wanting to prove themselves as good, loyal Americans again, the Confederates embraced the Yankees, and the Yankees embraced them back. They were both loyal, dedicated Americans fighting for what they believed was right. The Union was saved, mutually agreed to be a good thing. And they turned their mutual backs on African Americans, allowing the era of Jim Crow to spring up, allowing the Klan to resurrect itself, primarily, by the way, in the Midwest, which was fighting against the great immigration of Southern blacks to the North and fighting equally against Catholics. The North allowed a memory to grow in the South that the true heroes of the war were named Lee and Jackson and Stuart, not Lincoln and Grant. Lincoln's martyrdom was secure, and we all ignored the attempted ethnic cleansing of Native Americans led by Sherman and Sheridan and Custer. And believe me, Lee and Jackson and Stuart were indeed immortalized with statues and monuments and streets named for them. In the South, in the early 20th century, it was not uncommon to hear a little boy ask his mother, "Mom, I can't remember, was Robert E. Lee in the Old Testament or the New Testament?" And so it was in the South. It was about states' rights. Robert E. Lee was a hero. Confederate soldiers were noble. And this persisted until the aftermath of World War II, when African Americans began to assert themselves to gain the rights that they thought they had gained with the passage of the 13th and 14th Amendments. Before the Civil War, we could have said our Pledge of Allegiance to the flag with one nation, divisible, with liberty and justice for a few. After the war, we changed it to indivisible, and with liberty for all, but maybe not so much that justice stuff. So white people across the South, and also where there were large black populations in the North, in the cities, resisted. And we all watched on TV when we were young as a white cop with a billy club, German shepherd, and fire hose would assert white supremacy right in front of a crowd which carried a variation of a Confederate battle flag. That exact flag was almost never used during the 1860s, but it became the symbol of racial suppression, and it became known as the Confederate flag, now adorning T-shirts and bumper stickers. It didn't take a lot of imagination for the North and for African Americans across the nation to revise their memory of the Confederacy. Not only were Southerners the only slave owners, they were also responsible for all white supremacy. And the memory that was seared in the minds of a nation in our youth was that Robert E. Lee was a racist, not a hero. And it has carried on to other people from the South. Thomas Jefferson, and I was looking at some fabulous Thomas Jefferson documents that are here in the collection at the Massachusetts Historical Society. Thomas Jefferson is now discussed more in the context of Sally Hemings than the Declaration of Independence. George Washington, the father of our country, who was first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen, has his last will and testament analyzed and questioned more than his farewell address. This is a national phenomenon, not a northern or southern one. The Confederates are so closely identified with 21st century racism that many white southerners are now embarrassed of their own heritage because they can't draw on that northern treasury of virtue. In the 1960s, I was a kid during the centennial. It didn't seem odd to me that as a nation, we remembered that all soldiers, North and South, were noble. It didn't seem odd that so many streets and high schools were named after Confederates. And it didn't seem odd at all that blacks weren't mentioned. As a nation, we made a huge mistake in the centennial by eliminating black people from the conversation. But now, at the time of the sesquicentennial, Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, the home of Lee and Jackson and Stuart, is commemorating the Civil War more by a discussion of slavery and emancipation than anything else. It's a good thing that we now discuss it, but we didn't stop there. We are as silent about Lee and Jackson and Stuart now as we were about slavery and emancipation 50 years ago. We didn't correct the mistake, we're simply reversing the mistake. Whatever happened to Robert E. Lee? In 1907, at the commemoration of his 100th birthday, the keynote speaker was Charles Francis Adams, Jr. And I don't need to tell this audience who he was. And you know, he had commanded U.S. colored troops during the war. And he said, quote, "We are here today to commemorate the birth of Robert Edward Lee, essentially a man of character. That he was such, all, I think, recognize. For having so impressed himself throughout his life on his contemporaries, he stands forth distinctly as a man of character on the page of the historian." Why in Virginia have we forgotten Adams's words? I don't know about you, but I think it's time that the national memory gets back at least a little closer to its history with regard to the Confederacy. Let's do all we can to promote revisionist history, a better interpretation of the facts. But let's get those perceptions better in line with the interpretation. Were the Confederates bad people? I'm sure some were, but most of them weren't. Were the Yankees good people? I'm sure that most were, but some of them weren't. Were almost all of them, at least the white people, North and South, racist? By 21st century standards, of course they were. By 1860 standards, they were of their time, a little like Abraham Lincoln. Was the war about slavery? It's time the South admitted that the first wave of secession certainly was about slavery, not states' rights, even as we must all admit that Lincoln started the war to preserve the Union, not to free the slaves. This realignment of history and memory is the reason that I left a career as an investment banker in New York and Chicago and became the director of a history museum. This, I hope, is the reason that you belong to the Massachusetts Historical Society and come to lectures like this one. Thanks very much for inviting me.